Let me just start with this. How much of therapy has to do with love?
Oh, it's entirely about love. So it could be, can't be about anything else, really. It's entirely about love.
Month of Valentine's Day, which takes place tomorrow, and this is The Work Show. I'm Paul Smart, and this month we went out to talk to a number of different therapists about the work of love, the work that it takes to keep a relationship running. We ended up speaking with John McInerney of Athens, New York, and ended up just staying with that conversation. You hear it unfold here today.
Harold Harlow, who did the famous experiment with the wire monkeys. You know that experiment?
No.
It was in the 1930s. He was addressing the whole issue that the behaviorists had about the fact that feelings are meaningless, you know, that it's all just about behavior. Behaviorists had a very, you know, mechanical or mechanistic, I should say, approach. And Harold Harlow wanted to demonstrate that there was a lot more going on than that. So what he did was he had bred this whole little group of macaque monkeys. It's a very controversial experiment. He did an experiment where he had a wire monkey and a monkey covered in terry cloth. And the little baby macaques could go to either monkey to get fed. They preferred the terry cloth monkey. So then he took, it was a wire monkey covered in terry cloth, obviously. So then he took the food away from the terry cloth monkey, just the wire monkey had the food. So what he found was that the monkeys would go to the wire monkey to get fed, but then they go back to the terry cloth monkey to cling. You know, because it was cozier, it's warmer, mm-hmm. you know. What he said he was doing was that his experiments were all about love. And when he presented his paper at the, I think it was the American Psychological Association, in the early 30s, on his work, he said that he was presenting a paper about love, because it's really about attachment, the warmth and the sense of comfort that we get from being with each other, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So, and psychotherapy is really an effort to free us up so that we can find that place, you know, that we can form that attachment, that we're comfortable and easy with ourselves in that place, you know.
Is couples therapy a relatively new thing in the whole spectrum of therapy?
Well, couples therapy starts off as a way of helping people to have better marriages, you know, within this kind of, as far as I understand it, within this kind of spiritual, religious framework, I should say, where, you know, mm-hmm. it's important to have a good marriage and so on and so forth, so that you can produce children and make the church bigger, etc., 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 that kind of thing. So there's a lay side of couples therapy, which is how I would describe that. And then there's the more clinical side of couples therapy, which starts, I think, later than that, in the 50s, I seem to remember. You're challenging me now on my history of family therapy. But it's a branch of family therapy. It derives from the idea of systems theory and coupling, mm-hmm. and how that whole business works, you know. Whereas the more traditional lay version of it is more about, you know, ensuring that the woman is happy being barefoot and pregnant, you know, mm-hmm. and so on, rather than any kind of looking to find any kind of equality within the compact, you know, within the marital compact.
Is the idea of monogamy have like a solid basis?
I have my couples therapist view of it. You know, one of the things I say to couples when I start working with them, or at some point, not in the first session, but at some point within the first several sessions, you know, I'm gonna say something like, you know, there's no such thing as unambiguous monogamy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because we're different people, and it's very, very difficult to be in a monogamous relationship long term without feeling ambiguous about it. And unfortunately, what happens when people feel ambiguous about it, their relationship, their committed long term relationship, they have a reaction to that thought or that feeling. And the reaction is guilt or shame, because we uphold this idea of monogamy, you know,
mm-hmm.
socially, because it's, you know, it's kind of in some senses it's necessary to the social order, you know. But the whole anti-gay marriage business, for instance, is all about upholding the this notion of monogamy in an unquestioned way,
mm-hmm.
you know, and creating the illusion that monogamy is, you know, the highest possible achievement of, you know, heterosexuality. Maybe it is, maybe it isn't, I don't know, but You're certainly not going to enter into it without some ambivalence at some point, mm-hmm. might experience ambivalence. And the problem is that what people do with that, with those thoughts and feelings, you know. Sometimes they act them out. Sometimes they feel horribly guilty about them and they suppress them. You know, it would be much healthier if they were allowed to just have them, you know. Like, oh, yeah, you know, I feel like leaving my wife. I can't stand her, you know, she drives me crazy. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a lot healthier than trying to suppress that whole part of you and pretending it doesn't exist, you know. Or I want to kill her, or I have fantasies about her dying in a car crash on the way to work. You know, I mean, those are normal mm-hmm. things, you know. Normal in the sense that they're part of our repertoire of behavior when we're in this we make a bargain with ourselves, don't we? Mm-hmm. You know, we make this bargain of monogamy because it has social value, but we pay a price for it. And it's a matter of, are we willing to pay the price and how much of a price are we willing to pay? Mm-hmm. As a society, I mean, but also as an individual. I've had couples who've only recently met and they want to ensure that they can have a good relationship. And they're not sure they can because of their family histories, you know. Mm-hmm. So they'll come for, you know, to do some work and essentially have me reassure them that they have what it takes. And then you have people who are, you know, been married for 20 years and they're sick to the back teeth of each other and they want to get out but they don't know how to. Mm-hmm. And they basically want permission to leave each other, but they have a lot of history and they're very intertwined, but they're hurting each other, you know. Look, here's the problem. When it comes to something as complex as love, I mean, what's more complex? Right? It's the last frontier. Mm-hmm. You know, we have fMRIs and we have neuroscience and we have, you know, we can watch the brain as it's performing its various functions. And, you know, we're even beginning to understand a bit more about the universe, you know. But you have this incredibly complex thing called love. You know, which only gets more complex when you throw sex into it. Mm-hmm. You know, which is just, I mean, that's a whole, you know, universe of mystery all to itself. So, what do we do? We're trying to figure this incredibly complex thing out. And we have people who are supposed experts like myself, and then we have people who are supposed better experts than me because they can write a book about it, you know. And it's all about ideas, you know. We have ideas about mm-hmm. this thing, but then no matter what ideas are out there, no matter how, you know, how good the ideas might seem when you read them in a book, you come right down to it, it's an experience. Mm-hmm. You know, it's my experience, it's your experience, it's Fawn's experience, it's Deirdre's experience. You know, they're different. They're an internal state. Mm-hmm. It's my internal state and your internal state. And what we're doing is we're trying to negotiate our internal states into this world with each other. You know, I'm trying to negotiate my internal state into the mm-hmm. world that I have with you, and vice versa. You're trying to negotiate your internal state into the world you have with me. That's the dilemma, is what gets lost in translation.
much does all the expectations coming out of our culture from what we read, the constant drone of pop music and its expectations that it builds up, and all our movies and.
Well, you mean romantic love?
Yeah. I mean all that romantic love, stuff. Yeah. How does that then play into?
Oh, it's wonderful. It's fabulous. What would we do without it?
But how does it get reflected in what you're dealing with when people come? I mean, can people separate it, or do they get lost in that as well?
Well, we get lost in our ideas of what we think the other person is, mm-hmm. what we want them to be, of course. We get lost in our idealized version of them, don't we? Mm-hmm. I think Harville Hendricks talks about that. We have our, we have our dreams and fantasies, and we want them to be real, to actually come true. And when we first fall in love and we're swept off our feet and we have that feeling of, that oceanic feeling, the incredible feeling that you're bigger than the mountains. You can reach out and touch the stars. And, you feel you've met that person. You've landed.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, then the person is a real person, and you have to. At some point, the reality of who that person is going to through a process of continually banging away at your fantasy, is going, mm-hmm. Is going to emerge as a real person that you actually have to deal with. That's the process.
Yeah.
Everybody talks about that. There's nothing new there. But then it comes right down to whether you can, once you've done that. I mean, that's supposedly the basis for the 7-year itch.
Mm-hmm.
That mythical 7-year itch. It takes 7 years we're so stupid that it takes 7 years to get something through our thick skulls that, this person isn't a dream and a fantasy. They're actually a real human being.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have to start figuring out how to live together. Isn't that the problem, So.
Is there? Do you think there's a problem with the terminology? The fact that should there be more words describing love? On a spectrum from just pure lust and sex, and to.
Like the Eskimos with snow? Apparently, yeah.
I
think we need a more complex understanding of it. Yeah, we have a pretty simplistic adolescent understanding of it, generally speaking.
Mm-hmm.
The ancient Celts had a word in Gaelic. The word is Cnashiacht, as it's pronounced in Gaelic, and it's one of those words that has two meanings. It means at the same time bedfellowship and wound healing. So there's a sense that intimacy is a connection, is a healing thing,
mm-hmm.
right? And that's a pretty complex idea when you think about it. It's much more complex than the notion of romantic love that we have, which is essentially pretty selfish.
Mm-hmm.
It's about self-gratification as much as anything else. And it's even more complex, I think, but it's definitely more complex than the Hallmark notion, which is about just giving somebody a card or giving somebody a bunch of flowers or
mm-hmm.
buying somebody gifts or whatever. It's much more. It's probably closer to the Buddhist idea, which is about connection and about compassion. And that's something that you don't. That's not a behavior. It's not an act. One thing I always thought about St. Paul's thing was that it's fairly prescriptive. It's a prescription for behavior. Love is kind, love is patient, love is forgiving, it's all good.
Mm.
But it's pretty prescriptive. It's an idea. You know, I'm not putting it down. I'm saying it's an idea. I think the Buddhist idea is more complex, because the Buddhist idea is really about connection and compassion. And in that sense, it's more about the mutual fragility and vulnerability that's involved in having a relationship with another person. You know.
So when you're working with either a couple or somebody individually, how do you activate this process of thought to explore through these various... And so far we've been talking ideas, but then how does that break down into the actual therapeutic process?
Well, the process is an experiential process, isn't it? You know, when you go to therapy, you bring your story to your therapist, and your story is your story, and your therapist listens to your story, and between you, you find places in that story where you can connect with each other. You know, your therapist listens and is very attentive and is very focused in a way that nobody else has ever been in your life, except, you know, probably not anyway, I think, right? You know. And so you connect with each other around these moments in the story that have to do with your feelings and your deepest thoughts. And in making that connection, that's part of the therapeutic experience. Where, you know,
so it becomes one of recognition. Or inner recognition and acknowledgement.
It's yes, that and of self-valuing, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because if your story is valued, then you feel valued, don't you? You know, your story is a description of your innermost self.
could drink a case of you.
Speaking with John McInerney of Athens about the work of love.
The chances that you'll be able to sustain a relationship in the long term if you continually dig your heels in are pretty slim. Mm-hmm. Most people understand that. You know. So we surrender. To be fair to myself and to everybody else who's in a long-term monogamous relationship, you're always trying to strike some balance between maintaining your integrity as a separate living organism, even though the idea that you are a separate living organism, for me anyway, as a Buddhist, is a complete illusion. You know, it's a fiction. Mm-hmm. That is just it's purely a, you know, an accident of consciousness, which is an accident in itself, you know. But you're still trying to maintain some balance between, you know, this fictional idea of being an assembled aggregate thing, you know, that has a sense of continuity over time, and being part of a relationship which is continually asking you to do things that you don't necessarily do, or that conflict with that sense, you know.
Has pornography become a greater force in recent years, or was it something that, is it an exacerbation of something that's always been?
Greater force. I mean, it's pornography is a dirty word, you know, Paul. I just think it's, you know,
or is it a place I don't of know use what in, you know, the whole mix of it all.
It's a word that we throw around that's supposed to call up in us some kind of negative reaction, I think, you know.
You saw that whole thing with the man who could, I'm not sure if he's off life support at this point. He was arrested for making Facebook entities to a teenager in Catskill. He was arrested, ended up on the cover of the Daily Mail.
Yeah, and he ended up hanging himself with his sheet in his cell. In the context of I mean, look, this kind of stuff is so tragic, mm-hmm. really. You know, when I saw that guy's face on the paper, it's just, what a sad, sad, tragic thing for a man of his age to be to place himself in a position like that, mm-hmm. you know, to be so overcome with desire. For love, that he can only imagine himself pursuing it with a child. I think what we're talking about is the reality of human life, you know, which is that on the one hand, we have this idealized notion of romantic love that we were talking about earlier on. Mm-hmm. And on the other hand, we have this horrendous horrendous mistreatment of human beings by human beings.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, the guy in the Catskill Daily Mail the other day is a rather sad, tragic example. But he's less than a minor player compared to somebody like Idi Amin,
mm-hmm.
you know, or who knows? You know, name the favorite your favorite tyrant, you know. I mean, this guy is less than a minor player.
But then does this idea, an ideal of love that we hold out as an answer to that, does that stem from the reality of love, or does the reality of love try to reflect this other ideal?
Well, I think the reality of love is the reality of human behavior.
So love is really not the right term then. It's the reality of people in relationship.
Well, love is a term that we use to describe an experience that we have of, you know, connection to another human being when we feel that connection in a way that just is so expansive and
mm-hmm.
beyond anything we've ever felt before that we don't know what to do with ourselves. That's one aspect of the experience of being human. Another aspect of the experience of being human is being so desperately alone and fragile and vulnerable and, you know, twisted, you know, that you end up on the front page of the Daily Mail, you know. I would say, anyway, as a therapist, you don't end up in the awful position that poor unfortunate guy ended up in if you've experienced love in your life, you know, in any meaningful way or to any meaningful extent. You just don't, you know. We're not people just don't go down that path if they know what love is.
Some kinds of love, a monkey read a tortoise. Between thought and expression lies a lifetime. The situations arise because of the weather, and no kinds of love better than others. Some kinds of love, a monkey read a tome, like a dirty French novel. The absurd courts the vulgar. Some kinds of love, the possibilities endless, and for me to miss one would seem to be groundless. La-di-da-da-da. I heard what you said. And some kinds of love, ooh, I'm mistaken for vision, like da da da. Put jelly on your shoulder.
close your eyes must put a joy on your shoulder. Lie down upon the carpet between the old and expression. A little snail kiss the culprit.
This is the Work Show, February edition, Love. We're talking to John McInerney.
In the Buddhist idea, and in psychology, we talk about distress tolerance, and in the Buddhist idea, we talk about how we avoid discomfort, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so one of the things that happens when we avoid discomfort is that we end up not dealing with life as it is. We end up dealing with life as we want it to be. And for Buddhism, that's the source of all our suffering.
Mm-hmm.
All our suffering, because life is not what we want it to be. And it's probably never going to be what we want it to be, because life itself doesn't know that we exist. It doesn't know that we have desires and wishes and dreams and fantasies. It just keeps on being life, you know. It keeps on going. Time keeps on moving, mm-hmm. you know. But when we continually avoid discomfort, we become more and more isolated. And when we lose our capacity to deal with discomfort, then, you know, we lose our ability to really achieve our full human potential. Not our full potential in terms of, you know, the human potential movement. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about but our being our real, you know, being fully human, not
fully there,
not driving fancy cars, or not in any material sense, but in a more spiritual, psychological sense of being fully human. And when we aren't able to deal with discomfort and tolerate discomfort, you know,
we set up barriers, or we pull back, or
we minimize our opportunities. Mm-hmm. You know, we minimize our opportunities. I mean, if you want to sit around in your pajamas watching television all day, that's fine. But your life will be the poorer for it, I think.
Does love exist in that, at those levels as well? Or is that a false love? Or is all love?
Oh, it wouldn't be for me to say that it's false.
Okay.
You know? I mean, I think
love is the arena, in a way. Or the.
I think you can, you know. Well, maybe this is just, you know, I think love is everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
You'd be hard-pressed to find a corner of the universe where you couldn't find love. Unless you're in, you know, well, even in the most extraordinarily, you know, deprived and depraved circumstances. And I've seen places like that. I've been to places like that. You can still find love. You know. So I wouldn't say that love doesn't reach. The you know, the nethermost corners of.
Is love a political arrangement of sorts, or is it a, in the widest sense of the word?
You know, John Boehner and Obama would probably have something to say about that. I'd like to think they might, anyway. Is it a political arrangement? Well, of course it's a political arrangement, because, you know, you have to, you know, the whole basis of rapprochement, as the French call it, is, you know, to agree to disagree, you know, to kind of say what needs to be said to make each other feel comfortable. That's a political arrangement. It also happens to be a developmental stage in, you know, in child development, where the parent and child have to come to an agreement that, you know, you're okay, I'm okay, you know, that kind of thing, where they check in with each other, you know, non-verbally, usually, to begin with, but they're checking in with each other. Are you okay over there playing on the floor while I'm sitting here at my desk doing work? Yeah, I'm okay. Are you sure you're okay? Yeah, I'm okay. You're okay with me sitting on the floor playing with pots and pans? Yeah, I'm okay with that, sure. They don't say anything, but that's what's going on. They're kind of creating this space of where it's okay to be autonomous, you know? So yeah, love is a political thing. It has to be, because we have to create a space for each other to be autonomous, but at the same time check in with each other. You know, I've been going to the city for half of my married life every week, you know, for 20... whatever number of years, 25 years, 26 years. You know, I have to, you know, my wife and I talk on the phone. We check in with each other. You okay? Yeah, I'm okay. You okay? Yeah, I'm fine, yeah. How's your day? It's okay, you know, yeah. We're checking in with each other. We're making sure that, you know, I'm making sure that she's not packing her bags and leaving while I'm gone, because I'm gone, and she's making sure that I'm coming back, and, you know, that kind of thing. And I mean, at a very fundamental level, that's what we're doing.
I often stop and wonder why I appeal to men. How many times I blunder in love and out again. They offer me devotion, I like it, I confess. When I reflect emotion, there's no need to guess. Falling in love again, never wanted to. What am I to do? I can't help it. Love's always been my game, play it how I may. I was made that way, I can't help it. Men cluster to me like moths around the flame, and if their wings burn, I know I'm not to blame. Falling in love again, never wanted to. What am I to do? I can't help it.
Can't help it.
aside, how did you pull to Buddhism?
How did I pull to it?
Yeah.
Well, as the Quakers say, I was a seeker, you know. The Quakers called you a seeker when you first go to Quaker meeting. I went to Quaker meeting for about 15 years. But you know what they say, once a Catholic, always a Catholic. You can't, it's very hard to get rid of that kind of spiritual idea. Mm-hmm. The idea that there's something bigger than you, you know, which is the, you know, the fundamental Catholic idea, at least the more animistic Catholic idea, Christian idea that I grew up with, which is that, you know, there's, we're all the same, we're all connected, and then there's this guy up there, you know. Unfortunately, because, you know, it was 1960s Ireland, the guy that was up there at that time happened to be a fairly punitive, unforgiving sort of a guy who watched everything that you did, and, you know, that wasn't very good. But, you know, had I grown up in a different kind of, different place in Ireland or a slightly different time, it would have been a much more connected kind of God, because there was that very strong sense of connection to nature and that we were all the same, us humans, and, you know, we're all connected, and the birds and the trees and the fish in the ocean and all that kind of stuff, you know. So you have that, but then you have to sort it out from all the hierarchical nonsense that Catholicism loaded on top of it, you know. And when I lived in England, I found the Quakers, and they were wonderful people. I had tremendous, tremendous love and admiration for the Society of Friends. And when I came to New York, I discovered that there was, you know, one of the great meeting houses in America is right across the street from my apartment on 15th Street. So I started going there, and that was great. And then I went to look at an office for rent. And the guy who was renting the office was a guy called Barry Magid. And Barry, I happened to look at his bookshelf, and he had a book by Thomas Merton. And he was a Jewish guy, you know. Mm-hmm. Wondering what the hell is this guy doing with a book by Thomas Merton? So we got talking. I ended up renting the office. And a few years later, Barry started Ordinary Mind Zendo in my office, while I was still there. You know, I moved my furniture around, and I was only there part-time. I moved my furniture around, and we set it up as a Zendo, and that's how I started, really. It just, I sort of fell into it, you know.
Okay.
But it felt right at the time. Barry became, you know, my teacher, and the teacher at Ordinary Mind Zendo in New York, published several books now. Ending the Pursuit of Happiness is one of them. You might have come across that.
Yeah.
Ordinary Mind is his other book. I sort of fell into it. It was one of those things that just, you know, happens in the course of one's life. Yeah. When people ask me what Zen is, you know, I say, well, Zen is, it's the whole shebang. You know, that's what it means. It's the whole shebang. It's everything. You know, that's what the Buddha saw. He saw everything. He saw, you know, the passage of time, the development of the human psyche, you know, everything. He saw the whole thing. That's what he saw clearly. And that's what Buddhism is. It's seeing clearly, you know.
music this month included Love is Strange by the great Mickey and Sylvia, the wonderful Lisbon group Madre Deus doing Sur de Moraria, Joni Mitchell's effervescent A Case of You as interpreted by Prince, Some Kind of Love by The Velvet Underground, Falling in Love Again by the wonderful Marlena Dietrich, and finally, Kana Lamaza by the Ikwana Safa Musical Club of Zanzibar. This has been the February edition of The Work Show, focused on love. My name is Paul Smart, the show's producer, and we look forward to being with you again next month in March. Keep on working.